From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This is how the editorial cartoonist Steve Benson sums up his job: to throw the first punch in a bar fight. The idea isn't to be controversial just for the sake of being controversial. Cartoons are heartfelt opinions of the cartoonists. And when they're done right, they're also an incredibly artful way of distilling a complicated and messy issue into one powerful image. Benson says the idea is to kick the ball onto the field, to catalyze people into a discussion, and to do it, you get them outraged or amused or touched. Editorial cartoonists from around the country are holding their annual meeting in Salt Lake City this week, which gives us a chance to talk to them about their craft and their process. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to say what the pinnacle of editorial cartooning was, but it wasn't that long ago, in the 80s, when you had nearly 400 people making a living drawing for papers and magazines. Today, there are about 50 left. It's probably not surprising when you think about what has happened to newspapers in the internet era. They're still trying to find the right business model to keep themselves afloat, but there may be more to it than that. At a time when you have so many digital images competing for your attention, where does a cartoon fit in the scheme of things? In that sense, it's pretty remarkable that you still hear people in your office asking if they saw the cartoon in the paper. Maybe it was funny or outrageous, but if it got you talking, the cartoonists did their job. Editorial cartoonists from around the country are holding their annual meeting in Salt Lake City this week, which gives us a chance to talk to some of them about their craft and their process. We'll talk about boundaries, too, if there are any in this business, and just how they are adapting to the internet age. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us here in the studio, Kevin Cal Callagher is with us, the editorial cartoonist for The Economist magazine in London. He's also the cartoonist for The Baltimore Sun. He's just published a collection of his cartoons called Daggers Drawn, which celebrates his 35 years with The Economist. And Cal, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's good to be here.
Steve Benson is with us, the editorial cartoonist for the Arizona Republic, where he's been on staff for more than 30 years now. In 1993, he won the Pulitzer Prize. Steve Benson, welcome to you.
Well, thanks for minimizing what we do.
Pat Bagley is with us. He's been producing daily cartoons for the Salt Lake Tribune since 1979. He's written and contributed to many books on Utah culture. The most recent is called The Mormon Kama Sutra. And Pat, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here, Doug.
The Association of American Editorial Cartoonists is holding its convention, of course, in Salt Lake City, as I mentioned, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. They've got a number of events going on throughout the city. Well, I wanted to start with, for you guys, what is it that came first? Was it the drawing part, or was it the point of view part, you know? Or do they both just kind of mix in this? I mean, I know it does now, but what was first? Was it the drawing part?
You mean as children?
Yeah.
What drew us to it?
Yeah.
My dad used to sit in front of a TV, and he would doodle. You know, he'd draw the people on the TV. And so I assumed that every dad did that. I thought every dad knew how to draw. And so it's something that I grew up with. And I just assumed that, you know, it's what you do. So he demystified it for me. And I figured if dad can do it, you know, I can do it.
Yeah. So it was drawing.
Drawing.
It was, yeah. When did the opinion part come into it? Because seems like they all converge at some point.
Well, dad was the mayor of a seaside community in Southern California. And he was always dealing with politics.
Right.
And he's also a big newsreader. We watched the news every night. He read a lot of political books. He had Nixon's Five Crises signed by Nixon. And actually, he gave it away after Nixon gave his speech saying, "You don't have me to kick around anymore."
Yeah.
Too early.
Cal, what about you?
Well, you know, the first cartoon I can remember actually is an interesting mixture of the two. I was in fifth grade. I was at a Catholic school, and we had a nun who used to, in music class, sing with her eyes closed. And so I decided to, you know, I had to capture her on paper. And so I drew her, you know, with her big flowing habit and her mouth the size of a battleship. and the girl sitting next to me saw this, grabbed up and had a giggle, passed around. And soon the cartoon was circulating around the classroom, you know, and I was an immediate star until the nun got a hold of the cartoon. And she took me by the ear down to the boys' room and made me take a bite out of a bar of soap and told me, don't you ever do a cartoon like that again? And of course, I've been doing them ever since. But the idea was that I discovered the power that a cartoon could have, and that kind of tweaked something in my mind of being able to take the powerful and knock them down a notch.
Yeah. Was that the part for you, Steve?
Well, I remember my first cartoon that I drew as a child, and I still have it. We had a big family library, and we collected books, and I pulled this little children's book off the shelf, and it had its own illustrations, and I thought, I'd like to add to those and along with it, my own commentary. So I ruined books and right. and saved them at the same time. When I was 6 years old, my dad was reading the newspaper one night, the Desperate News Under the Light in Salt Lake City, and in the family room. I went and I said, Dad, would you draw me a bull? And he put the newspaper aside and tried really hard for about 5 minutes. And I said to Dad, I said, that does not look like a bull. So I decided at that point, if anyone was going to draw a bull, I'd have to draw it. And I've been drawing bull ever since. But those are two memorable events in my life. Yeah. And when I was a kid in school, I used to draw my classmates. I said, would you like me to draw you like really old, like 30?
Yeah.
And it was fun because people would look at what you did with a certain degree of wonderment. And it made you the center of attention in a way. With this unique craft that we came down the birth canal with. Yeah. You know, everyone's wired differently.
Cal, you've talked about something I wanted to ask you about. You say that the urge to draw is in all of us, like it's something in our genes, like from cave paintings or something right. like that. What do you mean?
Well, I think that drawing is like a foreign language in that every person has the capability to be able to do it. You know, so many people say, oh, I can't draw. Well, no, every person can draw. It's just a matter of, you know, learning that language. It doesn't mean, of course, learning how to draw turns you into an artist,
yeah.
because an artist is someone who learns this new language and then can write poetry in that language, okay? But so inside this ability to communicate using this unique form, because when you draw something, it's both satisfying for the participant, but also for those on the receiving end, it resides in a special part of the brain. And I think that, you know, just as Steve was talking about as a little kid, all of us were drawing at age six, but somehow along the way, many of us dropped off.
Yeah. So I know you're tired of this question, but I'm trying to sort of get at what you think the gift is of what you do, like the thing. And you often hear, well, it's distilling a complicated issue into one kind of image or a series of images. But how do you guys talk about it? What's the thing that you're good at? Besides just the drawing part.
First of all, you've got to have a fire at the end of the matchstick. You've got to have a spark, an intense curiosity, along with attendant opinions that drive you to want to express yourself. So being, as Cal said, just an artist, being able to draw a picture, replicate something, doesn't make you an editorial cartoonist.
It's the point of view.
It's the point of view that gets you onto the field. It gets you wanting to express. Pat talked about his dad being a mayor. My grandfather, you know, was a Secretary of Ag, and Cal had his own political influences. It depends on the mix into which we're born, and that's where we imprinted on the mama duck. And then if you can draw these cartoons in a way that in a moment can spark a visceral reaction, which we all have in our brain.
Yeah.
We all respond genetically to visual images, and some of us just know how to draw them because we're really interested in it. You practice more and more, and you just get better at it.
It's that visceral thing that
you've
talked about, appeal to the gut, I think.
Yeah. Appeal to the gut, right.
Uh-huh. Mm. Also, I think that there's also something else for us within the profession that makes us, I think that we see that maybe outsiders don't, is that compared to all other journalists and all other types of cartoonists, we are decathlon athletes because we have to wear so many hats to execute what we do. We have to be a journalist. We have to be a columnist. We have to be a satirist. And we have to be an artist. And the reason why there's so few of us is in part because this job is so incredibly tricky and requires so many skill sets to be successful.
We've got to be up in international news, on local news, on music, on the culture. You got to be a jack of many trades,
I think there's three elements to successful cartooning. One is knowing what's going on based upon an innate curiosity that you have, wanting to express an opinion about it, then being able to set a stage. You're a stage producer. Yeah. You have to have visuals in your head, so you set the scene on the stage, and then be able to draw as as Cal is a master at, caricatures, instantaneously recognizable elements, and then weave them all together in the visual path. So it's much more complicated than people who disagree with this say, well, you're cartoon today. You know, they put in quotes. It involves a lot of different disciplines. And we're not bragging, but we work really hard, as Pat said, to be multidimensional. Because there are a lot of tasks. We have a toolbox that has a lot of different elements in it.
So what is the thing, why is it that people get so upset over a cartoon?
I've been thinking about this. And I think it's because if we own anything, you think you own yourself. You know, it's yours, right?
Right, yeah, that makes sense.
And so somebody comes along and they show a cartoon, they do a cartoon of you, and they say, no, this is you. And you feel kind of violated because, no, that's not me. You know, I'm me. But then this person shows it to somebody else and they go, no, that's you. That looks like
you. At least that's how I see you.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you lose control. Yeah. These people have lost control of who they are. I think that's why they react so violently.
Mm. And I also think that one of our tools of trade is ridicule. And so, you know, we're not just writing like an editorial. People write editorials and people may agree with it. We're posing an opposing view, but we're also insulting them at the same time.
It's a combination of truth wrapped in mockery, and that's a mockery that outrages people. You can make an argument intellectually against a position. You can make your political stand, but nothing can withstand the tidal wave, the tsunami, the relentless, unrelenting wave of humor. No one can stand mocking. Just shows that you have absolutely no regard for the status, the profile, the position of the person you're criticizing. And so that is incredibly disconcerting to the targets.
I wonder if one thing you said, and I mentioned this in the introduction, Steve Benson, was that it's like throwing the first punch in a bar fight. Like the idea is, and not just for the sake of that, because you have an opinion, but the idea is, as you say, kick the ball in the field, get a what you want is people talking about this stuff, right? You want them engaging in it.
Absolutely. Actually, Cal Grondahl, and I always give credit to him, he made that observation. We throw the first punch in a bar fight, then stand back and watch everyone else join in.
I see.
People will write me and call me and they'll say, you ought to go to communist China and live there or North Korea or whatever if you don't like America. I said, no, you ought to go there because you would fit perfectly into the Politburo assigned to jail or execute cartoonists with whom you disagree. So what we do is under the banner of the First Amendment. Benjamin Franklin was an editorial cartoonist. Paul Revere was a lithographer and an editorial cartoonist. They realized the power of art, and they realized how it would stimulate the colonists to organize and to fight against the British. So that's what we try to do. We try to get everybody involved in this town square of dialogue.
Can you be neutral as a political cartoonist? I mean, Pat, Steve, you both. Cal, it'll be interesting to see your perspective on this because I'm not as familiar with whether or not you're up front about having an ideological perspective. Pat, you do. You cop to it.
But people don't realize that I started out Republican. I mean, I grew up in a Republican household. And when I started at the Salt Lake Tribune, I was fairly conservative. And, you know, you change.
But you have a point of view now. And you lay it out there. Steve, it seems like you do as well. Not about Democrat or Republican, but it seems like you have a certain worldview that you have to sort of lay on the line. And I guess the question is – and let me ask the question that I often hear about journalism in general and NPR in particular, which is, you know, are most political cartoonists liberal in their political persuasions? Let's start there.
I would say yes, but it'd be a small L. It's not a politically oriented liberal. Liberal people as a class are more inclined to be iconoclastic. In other words, challenging the status quo. So we're liberal in the sense that we don't care what party you're with, but we're more inclined to just aggressively challenge what everyone accepts as the norm.
Yeah.
Okay, so that would make us liberal in our outlook in that sense.
Well, I understand that, but we do have a lot of conservative cartoonists who hew the political right-wing line.
Mm-hmm. Right. And
some of them are very talented. If you look at the numbers, it's pretty close to being even, I think.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I just think that if you're more irreverently inclined, you're more inclined to to challenge authority in all of its expressions. And I think it takes more of a liberal mind. There's been scientific studies done that show that conservative people tend to be less inclined to challenge the system. They like to conserve. We like to challenge. I just think I grew up in a conservative environment, but I always knew I was a liberal down deep inside, trying to get out like the monster and alien bursting out of my chest.
Cal, what about you? How do you think about this? What's your point of view? Do you try to lay it out there when you're drawing?
Well, it's interesting, this conversation, because one of the things when with cartoons get together, there's as many different approaches to our craft as there are comedians and their approaches to that craft.
Yeah.
So you have the Woody Allens and the Chris Rocks, all different stuff. So everyone has a different take on this. So I work for two different distinctly different audiences, a U.S. American audience that works in a regional newspaper, and then a truly international audience of highly educated and powerful people. And I find that I wear a different hat almost every time I do a cartoon. Sometimes I'm doing cartoons which I'm putting my opinion straight up in front. And there's other times where I'm being more detached and I'm the journalist from 20,000 feet looking down at the idiocy and seeing the buffoonery in both sides. But all of them do have my voice and my point of view. But it's interesting, for example, with The Economist, they don't – just the tone of voice of the publication is not one for yelling and screaming. It's for a much more civilized kind of approach to things. And so the cartoons and the approach I do in those have to be kind of intelligent. They have to respect the environment that the cartoons are being housed. But the same subject I could approach in the Baltimore Sun, and I can be outrageous and be a bit more vibrant, I guess, in my work.
More colonial and less British.
There you go. I say, old boy.
Yes. Was it strange for you, Pat Bagley, and you, Steve Benson, let me ask you this. Was it at all strange going after President Obama for example, the NSA controversy or any of the other controversies that have been plaguing him recently?
Why would that be strange?
Well, because I think that there is some sense that you have been – you see President Obama is in a different light than you certainly did George W. Bush, for example.
Well, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
But people think that cartoonists choose teams. And we're so divided and things are so polarized these days that it's like you're on the blue team or the red team. And, you can't cross over. You've got to do the party line. You can't express an opinion outside of, what they believe. And that's just not what we do. I was never really a party hack. I'm not a registered Democrat. I'm a registered independent. When I come to an issue, I like to think that I'm looking at it independently. Yeah. I'd like to do the research. I'd like to read about it, find out about it and listen.
I don't regard myself as being a party partisan at all. I'm not on the red team. I'm not on the blue team. I'm on the black and blue team. I will beat up anybody.
Yeah.
But I am an independent with liberal inclinations. However, I think Obama has if this can be traced to the top when it comes to the NSA massive invasion of privacy scandal, he's in deep trouble. People don't really care about the Associated Press being bugged by the Justice Department. They care when their Facebook is being plumbed by secret agents who are going to be housed around the corner of Point of the Mountain in Bluffdale. Now you have crossed the line. I think what we're going to see here is true bipartisanship on the part of the American people rising up against a clear and deep violation of the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures. And I tell you, I had an epileptic seizure when I heard all this stuff happening. And Obama is now front and center in my scope. And I voted for him.
Yeah.
Cal, you feel the same way in the sense that are you seeing a different now image among all of your cartoonist colleagues in terms of the way they're portraying President Obama?
I've always felt that my colleagues were pretty independent. There are a few knee-jerk fellows, absolutely. And I've also, worked with many cartoonists around the world, and wherever you go, they are pretty much of the same breed. They're really kind of iconoclastic. That's what draws them to this profession. I know that my experience when I went to Great Britain and I was doing cartoons that are criticizing the conservatives and the Labour Party over there, I was able to do so quite easily because I was as an outsider, meant that I could criticize anybody and not feel I was betraying my tribe.
Yeah.
And coming back here, I feel the exact same way, and I think that was a great lesson for me.
There's something that's really frustrating to me that I've experienced over the 30 or so years I've been in the profession. People have a, generally speaking, a fundamental misunderstanding of what editorial cartoonists do. They complain that we are not fair and balanced. There was a great quote I heard from somebody who said, people want their news fair, balanced, and from their point of view. Right. They need to remember that we appear on the opinion page. I say to them when they email me, okay, just to be fair and balanced, I want you to alternate every other opinion between Republican and Democrat when you write me. And they don't want to do that. They want me to draw their cartoons for them. We are not news writers. We are not objective reporters. We are people who opinionate by illustrating our point of view. And as long as there's a mix of different perspectives on the editorial page, that makes it vibrant, that makes it stimulating, that makes it catalyzing, but we are not objective journalists. In fact, we are not true journalists. We don't write news stories. We are columnists with a Crayola.
Steve Benson is with us. He writes with the Arizona Republic. Kevin Kalkelleher is with The Economist and The Baltimore Sun. And Pat Bagley, of course, you know, is with the Salt Lake Tribune. Tomorrow through Saturday, the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists is holding its annual convention here in Salt Lake City. There are various public events throughout the city, including panel discussions, readings. There's a documentary screening and more. It all wraps up Saturday evening with a gala fundraiser when the association is honoring a missing journalist, the cartoonist Akram Razlan. You can go to our website for the particulars about that. You can join the conversation today, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org, and we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring the impact of a really good editorial cartoon. Newspaper cartoonists from around the country are holding their annual meeting in Salt Lake City this week, which gives us an opportunity to talk about the potency of these images. We have with us the cartoonist Kevin Kalkelleher with The Economist and The Baltimore Sun. Steve Benson is with us from the Arizona Republic, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and Pat Bagley, of course, with the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll give you more details about the convention a little bit later. You can go to our website for the particulars, too. And you can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Steve Benson, I wanted to ask you, several years ago, you had a very public fallout with Mormonism, in part over its treatment of your grandfather, who was at the time LDS Church President Ezra Taft Benson. This was in a time when he was deteriorating physically and, you, as you made the point, mentally as well. And I wonder if you still, in some ways, find yourself being defined by that relationship in some way, or if you kind of want to move on from that. I mean, that I have to say, in some way, that's how a lot of us here know of you when your name comes up. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not the case in Arizona where you're from, but I mean, do you feel defined in some way still by that experience?
Well, my break from the church in 1993 when I formally left the church, I didn't want to stay in. I didn't want to be excommunicated. I wanted to separate myself voluntarily from it and openly from it. Has defined me in many ways. I felt committed to and obligated to the Mormon Church as an institution, which I had been raised to believe deserved my obedience. My loyalty and my annual tithing support, and I felt after I did a lot of study, and because of the genetic accident of birth, I landed in a gene pool, very shallow and small little fishbowl, known as Mormon royalty, that bobbed around in the Great Salt Lake somewhere, and because of that, I had access to the top.
Yep.
I could talk to the president. I could correspond with him. I could, at the time, Spencer Kimball or eventually my grandfather, I had private meetings with Apostles Oakes and Maxwell and talked to the Correlation Committee director. All these people, Marky Peterson, another apostle, Bruce R. McConkie, I had direct contact with these people, and they would not answer my questions. And when they did answer my questions, it was the Play-Doh boy. I mean, they were ducking and dodging and weaving and manipulating all this stuff. And I came to the conclusion that I could apply to not only the Mormon Church but other institutions this little maxim. Hmm. Any institution that denies you access to information that you need to make, that you need for making rational and informed decisions, deserves your skepticism. That could be culture. You could be a football coach at Penn State. You could be the president. It could be of the United States. It could be your local Kiwanis Club leader. It could be your teachers, you know, your PTA board. It could be your church. It doesn't matter. Are they denying you access to information you need to make informed and rational decisions? And I apply that across the board. Mm-hmm. In my particular case, the Mormon church experience was very personal to me because I felt betrayed.
Right. Pat, what about you? Had experience with Mormonism, of course, all your life.
Well, I grew up in the church, born in Salt Lake City. But I describe myself as a Mormon emeritus. I'm kind of on hiatus, vacation, permanent vacation. you know, and the thing about being Mormon is it's pretty tribal. It's a part of you. And, you know, it's still a part of me. You know, if people ask me if I'm Mormon, it depends on who's asking. You know, but I might say, sure. Yeah. You know, they know I'm from Salt Lake City. They know I grew up in the church. And it's still a part of me. And I can't cut that out and say it's not there.
That sense that Steve was talking about, though, the idea of an institution trying to sort of spin something, did you get that same kind of insight? Do you,
you know, I remember the incident where I was reading is an English translation of the Bible, or a, yeah, of course it was English, but a modern translation of the Bible. And there's Jesus saying to his apostles, he says, "See that you call no man father because you got one father." And says, "See that you call no man leader because you have one leader." And I thought, you know, we always talk about the leaders of the church. And that was the moment where I think there was that final straw, that final break.
Cal, how do you – I mean, this is – your personal story is different from these guys for sure. But are you seeing the sense of skepticism, or is there something else that's tying you all together, if that makes sense?
You know, the skepticism is the perfect thing in the way that Steve described your overall skepticism of all institutions. I think it's something that runs in the blood of cartoonists. It's really quite interesting. And I remember, however, raising my kids thinking that, you know, healthy skepticism is an important part of being a member of democracy. But the problem is when you're raising your kids, it means that they're very skeptical of you as a parent, as an institution. And so that makes your job a lot harder. But it's also is a good lesson for us as cartoonists because we are taking on powerful people and they look at us skeptically as well.
Can I say something real quick? I remember Dallin Oaks told me in a private conversation.
Let me just mention that's a Mormon leader and a Mormon apostle.
Yeah, Mormon apostle, yeah. Still alive and kicking. He was complaining about a fellow apostle, Boyd K. Packer, who had been involved behind the scenes in a unpublicized excommunication process against a prominent local Mormon critic, Paul Toscano. And I asked him about Packer's involvement in that, and this is what Oakes said about Packer. Quote, "You can't stage manage a grizzly bear," unquote, referring to Packer. You can't stage manage editorial cartoonists, and you can't stage manage American citizens. And those of us who get angry, particularly if we come from backgrounds where we were controlled and repressed by institutional interests, won't put up with that. And so what you're seeing is a very personal, in my case, reaction to efforts to control me, to manage me, or to deny me essential information. I refuse to be stage managed. And that's, like Pat said, why a lot of us, and like Cal said, are independents. In Arizona, we don't have an independent party. I'm a member of the other party.
Is that what it is?
They call us others.
801-585 West is the number to join the conversation. Email address radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Trevor is joining us in Lehi, Utah. Trevor, hi.
Hey, Doug. Hey, how are we doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, real quick, I'm from Lehi, born and raised in the Mormon Church, active member. I consider myself a conservative-leaning libertarian. The quote, and I made this up, unless you can find someone who said it before me, I may not agree with what you're saying, but I will defend until my death your right to say it. And, you know, with political cartoons and things, I remember, you know, seeing a lot of them about George W. Bush, and I was a fan of George W. Bush. Don't hang up on me for saying that. But, you know, once in a while there'd be a cartoon, something was going on, and someone would draw a cartoon, and I'm like, yeah, I really hate that cartoon, because I see truth in it. And it was truth outside of the voices in my own head. And I had to kind of admit that, gosh dang it, I don't like it, but that cartoonist nailed it, right? And you know, with the current president, things will go on, and I love to see a cartooner once in a while, they really get him, and they get to the truth of the issue. And I'm like, yes, they scored one. They got a zinger in, and some truth was exposed. And I think there's value in having hearing opinion or viewing opinion, again, beyond the voices in your own head. And I may not agree with it, but it gets me thinking. Hmm. And I love Pat Bagley's cartoons. I see them a lot. And he does a great job. Keep it up, you guys.
Thank you.
He's getting at that visceral thing you were talking about earlier, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yes, he is. When I see cartoons by my colleagues with which I fundamentally disagree, I never get upset. What I see is the actual expression in real time what the founders wanted this nation to be. And that was this dynamic mud wrestle. And so I tell people, look, it's just a cartoon. If you don't like it, learn how to draw or write a letter to the editor or shut up. I mean, you know, oppose it if you will, but I don't get perplexed at all at other people. I say, this is great. Keep it up, baby.
Trevor, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number. Let's go back to the phones. Chuck is with us in Tooele, Utah. Chuck, welcome.
Hey, good morning. I remember a cartoon with Angel Moroni and the words coming out the trumpet, resign, Ev. I thought that was pretty good. I've enjoyed your work over the years. I would say that not only cartoonists, but all journalists need to try. I would hope someday they can try to not do this extremism thing, pinging the public back and forth from one end to the other of the spectrum. I've worked my entire life in telecommunications. I've listened to thousands of phone calls because phone companies are legally allowed to listen to you all day long if we want. It's part of maintenance of the circuits. There's never been a requirement for wiretapping in that environment. I've never heard anything interesting ever in my entire life. So people are far too worried about it. And there's some, you know, the postcard doctrine in law about anything sent email is openly readable because it's not encrypted and so forth. So if you guys could just get a little more educated, this has been going on forever. Look at what Hoover's done. But the comment that I found most telling is, I don't remember which one of you guys said, that any institution that doesn't give you the information you need to make an informed decision, you know, doesn't deliver the goods, well, just turn that around. The U.S. government, the NSA, they need information, too, to make their decisions. It's very important, okay? So you want the Mormon Church to give you all the dirt that you might think is lurking in some vault in Temple Square so you can make your decisions and base your life story on what you consider to be truth. But then if our nation state wants information from you looking for dirt that they can make decisions to keep us all safe, then that's not good. So I just hope that you guys could, the whole industry, the whole journalistic industry could work towards, let's take a Zen approach, let's shoot a little more moderation here. But I enjoy the comedy. Thank you.
I so fundamentally disagree with that.
I imagined you would.
The government does not have the right under the Fourth Amendment to search or seize without probable cause. It has to go to a magistrate, demonstrate why this person needs to be investigated, to be snooped on, and then you need a warrant that identifies the place and the person to be searched or seized. This is not just maintenance of a grid system for the phone company. This is the government actually getting into your life. I find that so uninformed and dangerous. I'm sorry, my friend in Tooele, but whoa, I think you ought to join the NSA.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let me ask you this. Are there any sacred cows? I guess the question is, what is the line over which you will not cross? And let me propose one. Would you ever show an image of the Prophet Muhammad like a colleague in Denmark did so famously
I faced something similar a few years ago. And it was when Gordon B. Hinckley became president of the church and became very public, and he was out there on 60 Minutes and on Larry King Live. And as far as I knew, nobody had ever really done a cartoon of a living president of the church, you know, certainly not at the Salt Lake Tribune. And I thought, well—
now, I've heard you say that. I find that hard to believe, but I guess it's true. I've been looking. There was no cartoon of an LDS church president.
That's right. And so I had to think, it was the first time, you know, it was going to be done.
Yeah.
And I thought, can I do this? Should I do this? And so it's kind of like the Prophet Muhammad thing. You know, what's going to happen? Is there going to be a fatwa? You know, am I crossing a certain line that I shouldn't cross?
You were nervous about it?
Yeah, I was a little bit worried about it. Yeah. You know, it was new territory.
Right.
So I went ahead and did the cartoon, and I found out that there were any number of people who were willing to be upset on Gordon B. Hinckley's behalf. But— you know, somebody showed him the cartoon, and I heard through back channels that he liked it because he looked kind of cute. So, yes, I did have to think about that. And, you know, what are the repercussions? Is this something sacred? And that was the accusation that I got from a lot of people, is you've taken something that's sacred and you've demeaned it.
Yeah. Cal, what about you? Is there a line?
Well, you know, I had the opportunity to represent the United States at lots of different countries around the world, talking and acting as an ambassador to freedom of expression. And the same question comes up as, you know, where do you draw the line?
Right.
And my experience is it's never the subject that you cover that causes the problem. It's how you handle it. Hmm. So even drawing the Prophet Muhammad, let's just say, or dealing with that subject the way the Danish cartoonist did, and they were complaining, by the way, the root of that conversation was that they were complaining that a children's book publisher wanted to do a book about Muhammad and no illustrator would come and do it. So they thought, oh, well, we want to prove that we can draw Muhammad in our country.
Yeah.
And they asked 50 cartoonists and 38 of them said that was a stupid idea. And then 12 decided to come on board.
Yeah.
But you could – if you have an opinion about that, you could still do a cartoon about it that didn't even have Muhammad in it. And the reason is that if you knew that by using inflammatory imagery or metaphors that you were going to create such a ruckus that nobody was paying attention to your point, thus making your cartoon unsuccessful and ineffective, you can choose to make your same point in a more effective way. So in my opinion, it's all be an effective cartoonist, be a successful cartoonist. It's just the way you tell the story, not what you're talking about.
What do you think, Steve?
I would agree. I would think – I don't believe there should be any sacred cows, but there should be individually diagnosed approaches to how you deal with the sacred cow. No topic should be off limits. You never want any special interest group or politician to believe they're safe. They'll never be criticized. I wanted to do a cartoon on Muhammad just as a matter of principle. I didn't know what I wanted to say at that moment. My editor said, no, well, we'll get death threats. And we did. We've gotten death. I got death threats over Elvis Presley cartoons. I can imagine what would happen if I did one on Muhammad. But I had some devout Muslims on their prayer cloth, you know, praying for, you know, domination and subjugation of the Western evil forces. And then I had my editor cowering underneath underneath his desk with his rear end showing on his own prayer cloth, looking for protection, and he allowed me to draw that. I could draw his behind, but I could not draw the face of Muhammad.
Wow.
I'm still trying to process that.
There's a cartoon, Steve Benson, that I think is interesting in terms of what it is that – let's talk sacred in different ways now. Mm-hmm. There's a cartoon you drew that created a real stir. It was in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing. And it related to this question of whether the domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh should get the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Describe this cartoon, if you would, and the reaction to it.
Well, what happened in that is, as all of us here can attest to, is when you take icons, when you take images that are part of culture, part of our gut, part of our history, and then you use them to as a vehicle for a political message. That's when you get into hot and deep swampy water.
Yep.
And then so I showed the firefighter carrying what was essentially a dead baby out of the rubble of the Murrah building in Oklahoma City.
It's an iconic image, as you
said. Iconic image, like the Statue of Liberty. It's like Mount Rushmore. It's like the eagle, whatever. And he was labeled the firefighter was going to be my metaphor for death penalty proponents, capital punishment proponents. And so he's labeled as such, and the baby says to him, please, no more killing. I was opposed to the death penalty, but I was in favor of the conviction and life sentence of Mr. McVeigh. What happened was ABC...
let's mention that the firefighter in response says, oh,
stop your whining.
Yeah,
right. I forgot to mention that. Not that I wanted to forget it, but now that you mentioned it, it's been a few years. But anyway, that took on a life of its own. Started with some protests up in the Northwest by some firefighters who thought I was attacking firefighters, and I wasn't. I worked as a cop for 9 years. I worked with paramedics and firefighters. I respect them. I know what they do, and I appreciate what they do, as we all do. But nonetheless, ABC Good Morning America brought me in to be interviewed by Katie Couric. And guess who I was on a split screen with? The mother of the dead baby.
Yeah.
There was no way I was going to debate her, this grieving mother. I said, look, we all use this image, and this is the first time that we've had a real controversy over it. Why? Because it's got a political message with which people disagree. But this is where you get in this very touchy, swamp of how are you going to express your point of view. And as Cal said, sometimes the din of opposition can overwhelm the message you were trying to convey. So it's incumbent upon us to look at our experience and say, could I have done this differently?
So was that a successful cartoon?
Using an iconic image like that, you don't have much wiggle room. I think I would have used it again.
Really?
Yeah, because it stimulated, got kicked the ball onto the field.
Yeah, for sure.
I didn't mean to insult the mother, but she hadn't complained when I did a similar image using the same image with the baby giving a thumbs up when McVeigh was convicted. Now, when I came out against his execution, that's when the mother started to complain, and that's when others complain. But that's the nature of our business. I'm not complaining about it, but it always raises the question, could we have done it better?
What about the rest of you? Boundaries, anything else to say about that? At what point is it so outrageous that it becomes counterproductive? You must think about those things a lot, right?
All the time.
Yeah. There was that cartoon just a few months ago with it was the chemical plant that blew up in Texas. Right. And I did a cartoon that was very similar to a cartoon that Jack Oman did in California. And Governor Perry picked up on that and claimed that he was making fun of the death of 11 people in this place in Texas. And Governor Perry completely misunderstood the meaning of the cartoon. And I think he deliberately did it to take away the focus from the fact that Texas is like Bangladesh as far as regulation goes. You know, low regulation, you're going to get accidents like this. So he was deflecting attention away from, you know, his pro-business, anti-regulation stance.
What about you?
Well, no individual cartoon that I've done comes immediately to mind. But the thing is I've seen the same issue play out in other countries as well, where you have culturally specific areas of sensitivity that if you're not aware of, you can stumble into and get in trouble real fast. But here's the other part of it. Now with the internet, the world is our audience. And so that, you may do a cartoon Jack Oman did in Sacramento targeting a California audience. It's picked up in Texas. It's misread, and you get all sorts of problems. There was also an instance about 7 years ago where a cartoonist in Canada did a cartoon about a tragedy in Algeria where a group of about 40 people were massacred. He did a cartoon that was kind of saying this is a terrible thing. Well, anyway, some jihadist groups got a hold of this and willfully misread it as well. And then suddenly he had a death threats fatwa on him, and he's from Algeria because the cartoon appeared on the web. So yes, there's even more reason why we have to be aware of this stuff today.
I got a phone call once from somebody who had a layover in Salt Lake City just long enough to buy the newspaper, and he called me from New York, and he was just terribly upset. And the cartoon was showing it was when BYU is building their center in Jerusalem, and I showed in this cartoon these Orthodox Jews who were having they had placards that said, you know, Mormons go home and BYU go away and stuff like that. And these two BYU co-eds are coming around the corner, and they see this and they say, oh, they must be Ute fans. Right?
Right. Oh, so this guy, smelling salts, please.
So this guy, you know, back in New York City, he doesn't understand the culture here. He doesn't understand all that kind of stuff. But he's absolutely certain that this is anti-Semitic, yeah. Right? And so I try to talk him down, and he's not having any of it. You know, he's convinced that this is an anti-Semitic cartoon. So I refer him to the rabbi, the local rabbi, to explain it to him.
Wow. How did it come out?
Oh, it was fine.
It's interesting. You really are walking a tightrope. A lot, aren't you, when you're doing this stuff?
Oh, you get, 85% of our contact with the public is negative,
yeah.
Because we deal with ridicule like we discussed before. We're dealing with caricature, and you touch this hot nerve with people, and they feel empowered to let you know. And so when we get together, the reason why we so much enjoy getting together is that we all like each other. We finally find them both people in the same room that will kind of like us.
For the first time in my 30-year career, I actually have chosen to prosecute at the at the suggestion of the reporting police officer and the police detectives, an individual who called and threatened me with physical harm over a cartoon I did using the metaphor of the guy in Ohio who had kept his woman friend
three of them
in a basement. So I had an elephant keeping three women in a basement over reproductive rights, equal pay, and equal work. And he just went apoplectic over it, called me 115 times or so in 2.5 hours, and then threatened to hurt me. And I thought, well, we're going to teach this guy a lesson, because there are boundaries there, even for the public. And you can tell, you can call me every name in the book, but when you actually threatened to hurt me, even though I may or may not have felt physically intimidated by him, you've crossed the line. And so now he's going to be facing a judge, and we're going to win.
Steve Benson is with us with the Arizona Republic. We have Pat Bagley, of course, with the Salt Lake Tribune, and Kevin Callaher with The Economist and the Baltimore Sun. And tomorrow through Saturday, the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists is holding its annual convention in Salt Lake City. A number of public events. You can go to the website to find out the particulars. Let me mention Cal's book, by the way, which is I don't have it in front of me. Cal, mention the name of it. It's big and
Daggers
beautiful.
Drawn.
Daggers Drawn. Yes, 35 years of Cal cartoons in The Economist.
We have a book signing.
Sorry,
the King's
go ahead,
English
Pat.
Tomorrow at 7 o'clock.
Oh, there's a – right. We'll get that on the website as well, and we'll mention that a little bit later. But we'll take a quick break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with cartoonists Kevin Callaher, Steve Benson, Pat Bagley. They're here for the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, which is holding its annual convention in Salt Lake City, which is giving us a chance to talk to them about their work. And let me go to the phones. Gina has been waiting in Salt Lake City. Gina, welcome.
Hey, Doug. It's Gina Barberi. How are you?
Hi, Gina. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
I'm a huge fan of Pat, and I want to tell you about my very favorite Pat Bagley cartoon, which I have hanging in my 8-year-old daughter's bedroom because I think it has such an important message. It says, "What the terrorists are more afraid of than American guns or tanks or bombs is a little girl with a book." And it's a picture of Malala Yousafzai, I think is how you say her name. And I just think that's such a powerful, positive message. I want my daughter to have that ingrained in her from a young age, and I want to thank Pat for putting that message out there.
That cartoon had it went viral. It just went all over the place, and I knew that it had I knew that it had gone all over the world when I started getting images of it back translated into Croatian and Italian and French.
It's such a great story, because I think that, and I'm sure you've all had this same kind of experience, something that really touched someone in a way, and you're hearing back from them, not pissed off, not, you know, wanting to argue with you, but just sort of jaw-dropped like Gina was with her and wants to share this with her family. I mean, that's got to be nice.
Oh, it does feel good. Yeah, you bet.
Yeah.
Probably the most iconic cartoon image in recent memory was when Bill Malden did the cartoon after the assassination of President Kennedy, for which he deserved the Pulitzer and didn't get it. But it showed the Lincoln Memorial statue bending over with the president with his head in his hands. And that resonated so deeply with people around the world. This is what we're striving for, either in a very critical way or in a very touching way. It depends on the mood and the appropriateness of the moment and the issue at hand.
Yeah. Gina, glad you called. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Well, I want to sort of work our way to this question that I had proposed at the beginning of the show, and that is, in an era of the internet, you have lots of digital images, people have access to videos and all kinds of things that can express points of view. What's the role of a cartoon?
Well, like you said at the beginning of the show, is that, you know, people go into the office and they say, "Did you see today's cartoon?" And, you know, to your listeners, when was the last time that you saw a cartoon? Probably within the past couple of days. So it's still very relevant. You know, even though we have fewer cartoonists and it's harder to make a living doing this, my cartoons are now seen by more people than ever before. You know, they go all over the world. Instead of just
they're not paying, though, Pat.
They're not paying. Well, that's it.
That's the problem, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, we saw, I think, a magnificent demonstration of the adaptability of cartoonists to the changing world of digits, and confirmation of the adage, you know, evolve, change, or die, with a presentation that Cal gave yesterday in a little bookstore to a small audience. But I think this guy is the multimedia wizard and the king of survival. And I think maybe Cal could give us some insight.
Yeah, three-dimensional images. Is it the John McCain stuff?
I've done all sorts of pushing the boundaries because indeed it's my feeling that we are – calling ourselves cartoonists is maybe an anachronism itself, is that we're visual satirists. Mm-hmm. We use whatever tools necessary, but we're using pictures. We're using our wisdom and our criticism to be able to get points across. And whatever way we do it, it doesn't have to be on print. We can do other ways. But I'll also add that, you know, you're talking about we're being competing with images. We're also competing with Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert,
right,
who basically create about 30 cartoons a night that we have to go against. And as a result, the bar has been raised for us individuals to be able to knock out something good. But here's the real reason why I think cartoons are going to survive is because you see it here with Pat Bagley. You see it with Steve Benson in Phoenix. And I guess I have the same sort of relationship with my audience in Baltimore. It's when you're local and you make an impact, there's nothing that can replace a local cartoonist.
That's your hook because it connects to them. They have a context for it, and that's how it resonates.
Well, they tried to replace you, didn't they, Cal?
Yeah, and they brought me back.
The Baltimore Sun let him go and then – asked him to come back. He says, "I'll come back with conditions."
Yeah,
If Cal wants to explain the fine print of the contract,
that's
he can.
Right.
And the Arizona Republic wouldn't be the same without Steve Benson.
Right. Well, no paper is the same without an editorial cartoonist. Yeah. I mean, we do the demographics. This is not a boast, but the fact of the matter is, there are more hits are cartoons in any newspaper. I safely say, than any other feature the newspaper or the publication offers.
Yeah, and I just heard that at The Economist, my cartoons are by far the most read things in their digital world.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's good news, guys. Thanks very much for joining us. Steve Benson with the Arizona Republic, Kevin Cal Kelleher with The Economist and The Baltimore Sun, Pat Bagley, of course, with The Salt Lake Tribune. And I'll mention Cal's book again, Daggers Drawn, 35 Years of Cal Cartoons and The Economist. And details, you can find a lot of events going on with the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists holding that convention here in Salt Lake City. Go to our website for the particulars. Gentlemen, thanks.
Thank you.
Great.
Thanks,
Doug.
Thanks
Radio
a lot.
West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.